Natural Resources Committee will come to order. The first item on the agenda is Senate File 1132. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have an A1 amendment to get the bill into shape.
It's in the packet.
This was drafted over in the House side.
Packets.
Mr. Chairman, this was drafted over in the House side, and our fine Senate counsel tell me that the amendment will really do a better job of clarifying what we're trying to do than the way the bill was drafted over in the other body.
This one on the 5th of March. Do you want me to move it, Mr. Chairman?
Okay, so who was moving it?
Senator Stump.
Senator Stump moves the A1, author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Stump and committee members. In statute, we have a provision that the lake trout fishing season is open from January 1 to October 31. Then by rule, the department actually sets the seasons within that window. And in northern Minnesota, it's very, very confusing because they set a season for lakes outside the boundary waters, a season for lakes inside the boundary waters, and an opening date for seasons that are partially in, partially out of the boundary waters. And frankly, I don't understand why they do that. And I live there, and I can't understand the regulation and why they do that. So what this does is just makes it clear that the season would start from the Saturday closest to January 1st to March 31st during the winter trout season.
Okay. Do you have any witnesses?
This is a constituent-driven issue. They don't understand it either. And it actually varies by a couple of weeks for some reason.
Is this current practice that you're codifying?
No. What I'm trying to do, Mr. Chairman, is have a consistent opening for lake trout season it's all in northern Minnesota because that's where lake trout are, is that it doesn't matter if a lake has trout in it, there'll be the same opener, whether it's in the boundary waters or out of the boundary waters or partially in, partially out, because now there's three separate openers that are within a couple two or three weeks of each other. Some of them actually open in December, like would allow this, and some of them are as late as mid-January.
Okay. And so the opener in the boundary waters for lake trout varies currently?
It varies from lakes that are outside the boundary waters or varies from lakes that are partially in and partially out.
Okay. So don't we want to just clarify the ones that are partly in and partly out?
What we're trying to do, Mr. Chairman, is say that it shouldn't matter whether the lake is in or out. I mean, a fishing opener is a fishing opener. I don't understand the department's rationale why it's been that way. I don't know that they have a good rationale for it.
Okay. Senator Stump, and why don't we have the department come up, too?
Mr. Chairman, and I just attest that a number of people have talked to me about going canoeing and not knowing whether one lake is open and they get into another lake and it's closed. And so it's very difficult to really try to track as to where they can fish and where they can't fish.
Well, I think those are very hardy individuals that you've spoken to if they've canoed between January 1st and March 31st in the boundary waters.
Ooh. Maybe they're snowmobiling.
With Arctic cats, right?
It's probably the snowmobiling. Yeah, that is, that's true. Okay, DNR, do you want to?
Mr. Chair, members, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources.
Why is there an apparent inconsistency with regard to the lake trout opener in the boundary waters and areas outside the boundary waters?
Mr. Chair, members, it goes back to the access and kind of historical drawing of those lines and seasons. This language, when it was heard in the House, we did amend it to be a report for us to come back to the legislature to report on those types of things with recommendations. So we're going to be working with the author to do that as this bill progresses here as well.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I think nobody really has a very good answer.
All right. Okay.
But,
all right.
But, Mr. Chairman, I do have another amendment, if I could. It's game and fish related.
Okay.
It's the A2 amendment. Maybe I could speak to it before the committee decides if they want to put it on.
Somebody's eating an orange. Somebody's eating or peeling an orange. I can smell it.
Why don't we talk about it and then see if there's a motion?
Mr. Chair, this issue came to me too late in the session to get a bill drafted. So I bring it to you today, and it's another constituent-driven issue. What happened to this individual, and I'm not even sure if he's in Senator Tomasoni's district or in mine. I know it's a 984 phone number, so it's either Senator Tomasoni has part of Embarrass, and I have part of Embarrass, so it's a constituent in Embarrass, Minnesota. And he called me in December, right after he came out of the courthouse, and he was pretty upset. What had happened to him was he was out trapping and got stopped by a conservation officer, and he didn't have his license in his possession. It was at home. He had a different pair of wool pants on, and he didn't have his license with him. And the conservation officer gave him a ticket. And he said, but, sir, I have a license. I just don't have it at home. I'll get it to you this afternoon. I mean, I bought a license. And the conservation officer said he didn't care. The law was he had to have it in his possession, and he gave him a citation. Well, the individual called me when he was coming out of the courthouse, and he was pretty mad because he asked the judge if he could have an opportunity to supply his fishing license or his trapping license, which he had with him. And the judge said the law clearly says you have to have it in your possession or you're subject to a citation. So the conservation officer was right. The person didn't have it on his person and was given a ticket, and the court upheld the law. And but it doesn't end there. He was mad that day, but he called me here a week ago, and he just received a letter from the DNR saying because he had a trapping violation for not having a license, he now has his hunting and fishing privileges suspended for 1 year. So I says, gosh, let me see if I can help. So I went and looked in statute, and sure enough, that's what it's not rule. It says it in law that if you have a citation for not having a trapping license, you lose your hunting and fishing privileges for 1 year. Well, now this individual's very upset because he had a license.
Yeah.
And so what the amendment proposes to do is give an individual who doesn't have their license in their possession an opportunity to provide it. And it has to, and the amendment's real clear, the license has to have been valid before the individual was stopped. And this makes game and fish licenses consistent with the same way we treat driver's licenses for cars. So, if, for instance, if you're stopped by a highway patrol and he asks for your driver's license and you don't have it, you have time to provide it before you go to court. And if you actually have a driver's license, you can't actually receive a ticket. So I don't understand, again, I don't understand why, if the person has the license, they not only get a ticket, but they lose their hunting and fishing licenses for a year just because they had the wrong pair of pants on that day. It just seems to me that we should give people who have forgot their fishing license or their hunting license at home an opportunity to provide it before they not only get a citation but lose their right to hunt and fish for the whole next year. So I think this is a pretty reasonable approach.
What does it mean on the last sentence of the new language? A licensee shall write the licensee's name in the presence of the officer to determine the identity of the licensee.
Chairman, I'd have to ask counsel why we need that sentence in there, if it's just an identification, verification, or what it is.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, that's modeled after the driver's license provision, and as I understand it, that's if you don't have your license on you, requiring you to write your name down will go a long way so the officer knows who they're dealing with, because you have your signature, and it could be compared to the license when you show the license to the officer at a later time. Mm-hmm. But that's it's the same language that in law right now, in section 171.08, which applies to driver's licenses. They have the exact same provision.
Okay. Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, members, Colonel Hamm is not available to be here. This is the first we've been aware of this amendment. I would like the opportunity to talk with our enforcement division about the situation at hand and also about the language here as it moves forward.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen and then Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the only question I had of enforcement was whether they have the ability to check on that license on site. I know that's always been an issue with the DNR versus peace officers. And peace officers can check via radio or cell phone immediately whether you have a license or not. Whether the DNR has that technology or not, I'm not sure. I thought they had, but that would have told the officer that he had a valid license.
Mr. Chair, Captain Conrad is here to address those issues.
Welcome to the committee.
I'm Captain Jim Conrad, Administrative Manager for the Division of Enforcement. Mr. Chair, Senator, we have the ability to check those licenses electronically only after returning to our home offices or our squad cars, depending on if we have air coverage, to get into the databases.
You get it immediately then. Excuse me. You get that information immediately then, as soon as you check? I mean, just like running a 45 or...
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, if we have the coverage.
Yeah.
The air cards don't work everywhere, so we don't necessarily have that statewide.
Thanks.
Senator Saxon.
Mr. Chair, I was going to move the A2 amendment. I don't think we've done that yet.
Okay. On the A2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So I think we'll talk about this more in between now and the omnibus bill. Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering, on line 19, it says, or satisfactory proof that at the time of the arrest, the person was validly licensed. What would be the circumstance if, let's say a person lost his license and then didn't buy another license? But had, let's say, a receipt from this previous license to prove that he had a license. I'm just questioning what we need that, or what circumstances would require that line 19.
Did you have intent on that, Senator?
Mr. Conner, I don't know if that's modeled again after the...
It is.
After the driver's license situation with public safety or not?
I'm hearing from Mr. Knopf that it's modeled after a driver's license rules.
Mr. Chairman, I think if you lose your license, I don't think you have to pay the full cost to get a duplicate license.
Right.
Is
right.
that correct?
Right.
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Connor, did you have a comment on that?
No, Mr. Chair. I was just here in case that was going to be directed to me.
All right. Further discussion on Senate File 1132. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, I do have a question on line 13 of the original bill. It now reads from the Saturday nearest January 1. That could mean that season opens in December. Is that what you intend?
Or Senator Fredrickson, that is what happens right now.
Okay. I'm just clarifying that.
It does do that now. In depending on which one of those, it's inside, outside, or partly inside, outside. Some of the seasons do open in December now. That's it.
Okay. We'll lay this over for further consideration in the omnibus policy bill.
I didn't take a vote on it.
If there's no further discussion.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Senator Bach.
it is amended.
We voted on the amendment. Senator Marty here?
Mr. Chairman, did,
we only voted on the amendment.
What was the action on that
The amendment passed. We passed the amendment onto the bill. Senator Marty here? Is Senator Olson here?
Senator Shadry's here.
Senator Bibble, do you have witnesses here?
No, see, we can, I think they're down in the cafeteria. We can go collect them.
Okay. Oh, we should probably have folks. I can take my bill. We can have this discussion now.
Let's keep moving.
Go Senate file 1517.
I know. Isn't one of them yours? Yeah.
Oh, that's Mary Olson.
There you go. Let's get it out of there. Come on. Throw it away. It's fine.
I do a knee jerk.
Committee, we're going to move to Senate File 1517. Senator Shadry.
Mr. Chair, this bill deals with aquaculture or the raising of fish in the state of Minnesota. It's been an issue that's been batted around, has received a degree of controversy to it, and it centers around the effect of raising fish, particularly bait fish, in naturally occurring ponds or wetlands. A person is currently allowed to get a permit from the DNR to raise bait fish, fathead minnows, white suckers, and other types of fish as well, walleye, muskie, and raise it in that naturally occurring pond or wetland. Fish rearing goes on in different capacities as well. There are man-made ponds. There are these vats that we kind of see in DNR fisheries. So there are different types of ways to rear fish. But the issue in this bill is how fish are raised in naturally occurring ponds or wetlands. So when we talk about a pond, that's what we mean. And the problem that has cropped up is that there is an ecological effect on a wetland by the rearing of fish on wetlands. Basic concept is you've got minnows, such as the white sucker or fathead minnows, that scurry around the bottom of the wetland, the wetland pond, and they stir up all the sediment, and they also eat all the little invertebrates that are in the wetland. So this has an effect not only on the water quality because the wetland becomes more turbid, but it also has an effect on the ecology because stirring up the bottom of the wetland prevents the growing of certain plants that other species rely on, and they eat all the little invertebrates that other species also rely on for their diet, ducks being one example. So we've talked about this issue for a number of years since I've been in the Senate. I think it's an important issue to address, and it centers around not banning the practice of rearing fish in these ponds, but to gain a better knowledge and to proceed with the rearing of
these fish with a better knowledge of what's happening and a plan to at least keep track of the ecology of any type of pond that is used to rear these fish. So DNR's got a brief presentation on aquaculture. They just finished a study this past November reviewing fish culture in wetlands, and they have some recommendations. I think it's important for members to take a look at, particularly the executive summary, because I think what it does is clear up a lot of confusion, not only on the part of the effect of minnows on wetlands, but our approach to dealing with this problem as well. I think it opened my eyes a lot to kind of the facts surrounding this, and sometimes, and I think it will shape our approach to this issue. So what I'd like to do today is get the PowerPoint presentation, go through the bill and address the issues that I think are going to help with this problem. We'll hear some witnesses for and against, and then we'll lay the bill over. And what I think, given some what I think were some positive conversations with some of the bait stakeholders and bait interests, I think there's potential for coming to some common ground on proceeding with this, and we'll lay it over and continue to work on that type of language with the intent of doing our best to come up with something agreeable. But we've got to, this is a piece of the wetland issue. We've been dealing a lot in this session with the amount of wetlands we have, but this goes to the quality of wetlands that we have. Now, must be clear, aquaculture is not the cause of wetland degradation, certainly not on its own, but it is a part of the issue. There's carps, there's bullheads, there's other ways that wetlands get degraded, but this looks at, we're looking today in this bill at a part of the issue, and that is not to say that we shouldn't be looking at the whole issue of wetland degradation. We need to be doing that. This deals with a piece of it.
Mr. Bogus, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife. And Senator Chaudhry has given a good overview of a lot of what I'm going to cover. I'm going to go through this fairly quickly and just try to make sure everybody's kind of on the same page as to how we got where we are and what some of the history of this issue has been. It's an issue that we've been talking about for some time, and that the presentation that I'm going to go through here quickly is very similar to one that I did at the Fish and Wildlife Roundtable that we had last January. And it kind of just gives in about 10 or 15 minutes sort of a history of the aquaculture program, at least in the last 15 years, and some of the processes that we've been going through to try to address this this issue between use of natural wetlands for raising fish and potential impacts that may have on other wildlife and other qualities of those wetlands. And Senator Chaudhry said there are a lot of factors that are affecting wetland quality. There's the physical, just how the water gets in and out of the wetlands, whether it's a discharge or a recharge wetland. Is it groundwater fed? Is it surface water fed? There's chemical nutrient issues. There's sediment issues. There's biological factors such as invertebrates and fish. And all of those, along with just the size, shape, depth, orientation of the wind, all of those factors can influence the quality of wetlands. So it's a very complex issue. And one of the key concepts surrounding the aquaculture issue is this idea of alternative stable states, where you have wetlands that can be in a clear water condition or what we call a turbid water condition, which means they're full of algae. They have that pea soup kind of a look. You can see here two wetlands in this slide that are side by side. The top one's in a clear water condition. The bottom one's in a turbid water condition. And that can be due to the influence of fish, or it can be due to some sort of runoff or other differential between the wetlands. And when you have these two conditions, On the left, in the clear water condition, you get a lot of submergent plant growth. You get a lot of invertebrates living there that can provide food to other wildlife and other fish that may live in the wetland. When you get over into the turbid water state where it's full of algae, the light can't penetrate, the plants die, the oxygen disappears, and generally it's an undesirable condition for most types of values of the wetland. Just going over real quickly how this can be affected by fish. On the left, you can see a clear water state where you've got a lot of submergent plants. That next level up from the bottom is demonstrating the amount of algae that's present in the water. And that algae is being suppressed, we think, by the zooplankton in the water. And the relative absence of fish allows the zooplankton to kind of keep that algae under control. When you get a lot of fish in a wetland, they eat the zooplankton, the little funny-looking fairy shrimp things in the middle there. It allows the algae to bloom, and you can tip that wetland over into a turbid water condition. Now, we've looked at a lot of wetlands. We've done a lot of research. We've got actually a research project that's more comprehensive than just fish, that's looking at all the landscape level influences on wetland quality that's in progress right now. We don't have the results of that one. But as we looked at fish in wetlands, we found that on the left-hand side there, you can see fishless wetlands tended to have a lot of the macrophytes, means the aquatic plants that are bigger than algae, the big aquatic plants. Those tended to be very abundant in the clear water state and almost absent in the turbid water state. And there appeared to be a relationship between those that had minnows in them and those that didn't. You can see the yellow oval on the bottom right there is wetlands that had minnows, and the red oval on the upper left is the wetlands that didn't have minnows. But you can see there were a couple kind of anomalies in there. So there's some general trends that have become apparent through research, but there are very few absolutes. And another factor that we think is important is that when a wetland shifts over from clear water to a turbid state, you may have to undo the conditions that caused that to an even greater extent to get it to flip back to a clear water state again. In other words, there's sort of a trigger that it goes from one state to the other, and it can be, you may have to push it back farther through whatever was causing it, nutrients or whatever, to get it to flip back to the clear water state than what it took to get it to flip the first time. So once it changes from clear water to turbid water, it can be very difficult to change back. There are a variety of ways that fish can influence wetland quality. We've done research on use of fish-eating fish, like walleyes, to try to control some of the planktivorous fish, like the fathead minnows, that cause the water to get turbid. And we actually found that putting walleye fry into a wetland that was full of fathead minnows could help to clear up the water, because they would suppress the reproduction of the fathead minnows. So there are some applications for using these piscivorous or fish-eating fish to suppress the other fish that are eating the zooplankton. We found it worked with fry in some situations. It didn't work when we put large fingerlings in, probably just because of the quantity of fish that we're dealing with. And this was written up in a report that was published in 2004 on using walleye stocking as a tool to suppress fathead minnows in wetlands, and we've done some of that since. We found that it works sometimes, it doesn't work other times, and it's probably because of these complexity of factors. Senator Chaudhry had mentioned there are a lot of other impacts on wetlands besides aquaculture. Some of those are related to fish, but not fish that are intentionally raised in wetlands. Fish like carp and black bullheads can stir up the bottom and suspend the sediments and destroy the aquatic plants, and you end up with a turbid water wetland. Just quickly on the legal history of aquaculture, it's been around for many years, but there was kind of a comprehensive revision of the statutes on aquaculture back in 1991. It was called the Aquaculture Development Act of 1991. Almost all the aquaculture statutes are in Chapter 17, but most of the responsibility for administering those statutes is given to Commissioner of Natural Resources. But among other things, the Aquaculture Development Act defines aquaculture as an agricultural pursuit. It says that the farms must be licensed and given classifications to prevent or minimize impacts on natural resources. It has some statements of principle, one of which is to protect existing natural aquatic habitats and the wildlife dependent on them. There's also statements about protecting the public's fish resources. And there's a statement in there that an aquaculture license is based on a determination that the licensee does not have a significant detrimental impact on the public resource. And I think it's clear at the time the Aquaculture Development Act was passed, there was an understanding that we could raise fish in wetlands, we could diversify agriculture through fish farming, and we could not impact the public resources. And at that time, the science was not very well developed on the impacts of fish and wetlands. There was some work that had been done, but the results of that weren't real clear at that time. This has been kind of an issue between fisheries interests and wildlife interests for quite a while. Back in the early 1990s, the DNR had an internal committee on fish and wetlands that looked at how we should license wetlands and what kind of criteria we should use to determine whether or not to license wetlands. There just wasn't good science at that time to arrive at good decisions on how to do that, and there was also a lot of legislative interest at that time in expansion of aquaculture, both by the private sector, which we license, and by DNR for our stocking programs. DNR uses wetlands for raising fish for stocking, particularly walleye and to a lesser extent northern pike and muskies. In 1999, our division in DNR came up with some short-term guidelines for use of wetlands that made it clear that there would be review by wildlife and fisheries of all the applications for use of wetlands. We convened a very large stakeholder process from 99 to 2003 that involved about 40-some constituents from aquaculture industry, waterfowl, wetland interests, fisheries, wildlife, other agencies, and they developed a report. There was also a legislative report in 2003 on aquatic farming licensing and how licensing was structured, fees, and so forth. This is just a list of the organizations that were involved in that fish and wetlands work group that met in the late 90s and early 2000s, and the report was issued in 2003. And there was agreement on some of the things that were fairly easy to agree on. We needed stronger wetland protection restoration, more flexibility in regulations, additional research on impacts of fish and other factors. They asked for some clarification of decision criteria for licensing. Wanted licensing decisions to be made consistently, and wanted a system of uniform landowner notification. So there was agreement on those issues, but it didn't really resolve some of the stickier issues about should we be using these wetlands and how should we decide which ones or how many to use. There became more legislative interest in 2005. There were bills introduced in the House and the Senate that are very similar to Senator Chaudhry's bill that we're hearing today, and that prompted us to pull together. We didn't want to pull together another large stakeholder process because we'd already been through one of those, but we wanted to bring together some of the experts from the agencies and the universities and ask them to look at what's the status of the science right now and what are the outstanding issues from these previous processes. As we did that, we developed some guiding principles, and those were that we wanted to be able to maintain our stocking programs that the state does. We wanted to protect the existing natural aquatic habitats and the wildlife that's dependent on them. We wanted to be able to continue adequate bait fish production. It's important for our anglers. They need the bait fish, and we wanted to provide for a sustainable commercial aquaculture industry in the state. We put together these ad hoc groups. The one that you got the report on today is the one on maintaining wetland values. We also asked a group to look at the licensing options, kind of a follow-up to that 2003 legislative report, and another to finalize how we would do this uniform notification and public notice that I talked about a few minutes ago. And as I said, these were agency and university folks that were asked to basically compile and bring up to date everything that had been done prior to that. This is the report that was issued last November that you've all received a copy of. And this one summarizes the science and takes a stab at looking at some of the criteria. Key findings are the whole summary of those is in the executive summary, but going back to what I talked about earlier on the Aquaculture Development Act, there's pretty clear indications with the current understanding of impacts of fish and wetlands that it's going to be more difficult to avoid these significant detrimental impacts on the public resource than may have been envisioned at the time that act was passed. We're seeing now that in most cases, the science is indicating that if you have a clear water wetland without fish, it's probably not a good idea to put fish into that wetland. If you have a turbid wetland, putting fish in it may not make it any worse. It may preempt some opportunities to make it better in the future. And we know that if you have a turbid wetland that's full of fathead minnows, putting fish in it, if they're piscivorous fish like walleye fry, may actually improve that wetland. But because this is such a complex issue and because there's so many different factors that affect wetland quality, we also concluded it's going to be difficult to make clear-cut criteria and determinations based just on licensing these wetlands for fish. So we were left with the issue of how do you accomplish the intent of the Aquaculture Development Act of not having a significant detrimental impact while accomplishing all those things that I talked about earlier in terms of maintaining our stocking and bait fish and protecting the wetlands and allowing for a sustainable industry. We've identified a number of options. Our belief is that this is something we need to look at as a long-term change. We'd like to look at the licensing structure. The fee right now is one flat fee to raise fish in wetlands. It's not tied to the acreage or number of wetlands that are licensed. There are inspection fees for each wetland, but there's one flat licensing fee. So we think that's an area to look at. Since this report came out, we had a meeting with aquaculture and some of the waterfowl and environmental interests in late 2006. Our intention as a department had been to have some language ready for this session. We had a placeholder in the governor's administrative process for policy bills, but this report we were expecting to have finished last August. It wasn't done till November. We'd like to have time to continue to work with Senator Chaudhry and others in the House and the industry and the waterfowl interests on some of the ideas on how to change how we practice aquaculture to move it towards a more sustainable way. One of the things we're looking at is kind of like we do environmental review, where we'd like to avoid the impacts where we can, minimize the impacts to the extent possible, and then if there are unavoidable impacts, we need to decide how much of that is okay and is there a need to mitigate those unavoidable impacts. We've completed the report. It's on our website. You've got copies here today. If others are interested in getting it that weren't able to get it today, they can find it on the DNR website. We just don't feel like we have the answers here today in terms of specific statutory changes. We've got some ideas that we'd like to continue to explore over the interim with the goal of having something next year. And I know that we've been talking about this for a couple of years and saying that we'd be bringing something forward. But it is a very complex issue. There are a lot of strong values on all sides of it. And I think it's going to take a little more time to come to a conclusion that maintains all of those principles that we'd like to be able to maintain. So that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Baugus. Are there questions? Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Baugus, the other side of this equation is a concern for waterfowl and waterfowl habitat. Has the department attempted to make any assessment of the impact on waterfowl habitat, waterfowl production, migratory waterfowl using these wetlands that aquaculture has had on those waterfowl habits and waterfowl habitat?
Mr. Chair and Senator Frederickson, we do have a study that's not specifically targeted towards wetlands that are being used for aquaculture, but looking at trying to get more data on waterfowl use of shallow wetlands related to the quality of those wetlands and the condition in terms of water clarity and vegetation and that sort of thing. Because one of the problems that we've had over the last 15 years is that when it comes to making a licensing decision, we just have not had much data on the wildlife use of these wetlands or lack of use of these wetlands. So that is an issue that we're looking at. Another thing that we're looking at is there's a provision in this bill that would look at easements that are obtained with duck stamp funds. So we are doing a GIS exercise right now to look at licensed ponds and see if there's intersection with some of those easements of duck stamp funds. So we're doing a couple of things that I think will start to get at what your question is asking.
Paula? Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Vargas, when you take a look at Michigan, do you see any distinct differences between the shallow ponds in Michigan and the ones in Minnesota in terms of the quality and then also the differences in duck populations?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf, I'm not familiar with the Michigan situation with their ponds. It's something we'd have to look into.
Mr. Chairman, it seems like...
Do you know about Wisconsin?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Vargas, on the back page of this handout, it seems like Michigan is the only one that has total restrictions on allowing the use of their public waters for aquaculture. So it would seem like that would be a good example to kind of compare the differences between Michigan and what's happening in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf and Senator Chaudhry also asked me about Wisconsin, which is also in this matrix that describes what other states do. In terms of waterfowl, I don't think anybody is saying that aquaculture is the key to what's happening with our waterfowl populations. There's a lot of impacts on our wetlands. It's one of many factors that may be having some influence. The other thing is that we're far west in the Mississippi Flyway, and we have the Prairie Pothole region, which Michigan does not have, which has a huge influence on our waterfowl because that's one of the richest flyways in the continent. So I'm not sure if doing that comparison we're going to be able to come to any real conclusions as to the impacts of aquaculture. I think, though, that we want to make it clear that we don't think that aquaculture is the driving factor on the duck situation. It's the amount of wetlands and the quality of wetlands, and they're being influenced by a variety of factors, and some of them are fish that have nothing to do with aquaculture, as I said earlier, but some of them have nothing to do with fish at all. It's just part of this whole large issue of how do we improve the quality of our wetlands in general.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, when we talk about fish farming, farming industry, has any of this been brought before the Egg Committee? Is this someplace maybe it should go, or has it ever been thought about doing there? Have they ever been a player in this at all, as far as the farming aspect of our fish farming?
Mr. Boggess?
That's a rookie question for you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, well, I don't consider it a rookie question because I'm not real sure of the answer. I know that Mr. Pyre is here, and he's our fisheries management section chief, and he was involved in the aquaculture Development Act process, and I'll just let him respond to that question.
Thanks. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Ron Payer with Minnesota DNR. Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebretson, we did go through the ag committees when these laws were promulgated. Last year, there was some discussion on aquaculture in Representative David's committee pertaining to another issue, and there was some broad discussion in terms of how much the Department of Agriculture should be involved. And at this point in time, there's been very minimal involvement by the Department of Agriculture in the aquaculture industry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, it was kind of all written under the ag statute, but then it was all handed over to the DNRs. If you look to references to the commissioner, that refers to the DNR commissioner. There are other references to the ag commissioner, but they deal with reports and such that actually we're not aware of ever been provided, but it just kind of was written there, and then it's always kind of just in practice been handled by DNR and wildlife.
Senator Ingebretson.
So follow-up, so it won't be going to the Ag Committee then?
You know, the aquaculture bills that we've had in the past several years never have. That's always been kind of considered to be game and fish. There was what passed last session was actually a moratorium on aquaculture. It actually passed the House and the Senate. There was a slightly different version in the House, but there were both two versions of a moratorium, not very strict moratorium, but there was moratoriums passed by both the House and the Senate last session, but they dropped off in conference committee. And I think one of the issues what we did last year was was based on the discussion from department that we're looking to we need more time to do something about this. And I don't question Mr. Boggs' sincerity on why they don't have anything this session, but I think that we have enough issues, we have enough answers to do what's in my bill, or a version of my bill.
Senator Ingebretson.
Just to follow up, yeah, the reason I bring that up is because of the fish farming aspect. I mean, obviously in my particular district, and I think as well as Senator Scogin's district, we have people who actually make a living on farming fish, and that's why I asked the question. I got some other questions. Do we wait for testimony on that, Mr. Chair, with regards to some of the folks that are going to be here testifying today? Or
do you have a list, Senator Chaudhry?
There's some folks from out of town. Let's take at least one witness. I think there are other folks from the state industry that want to testify too. I think Tom Landerwer is going to talk. Is he here?
Is he in favor?
Yeah.
Is Tom here? Tom is not here.
Oh, okay.
Anyone else who would like to speak in favor of this bill? Those against?
I'd like to speak if I could.
That's fine. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please take a chair and identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee. My name is James Bozick, and I own Bozick Fisheries in Garfield, Minnesota. And I make 90% of my living off of raising walleyes to stock Minnesota waters. And this would be a great impact on me. And I've got just a brief letter that I'd like to read to you. If I could get them handed out. I don't know how that works.
We'll send someone up there to get that.
Okay.
Thank you.
But I can go ahead and read it, and then I'd love to answer any questions any of you to have. In 1987, I was told by the DNR that I was too efficient of a producer, and the first private walleye fingerling purchasers were discontinued just after the completion of the Lake Christina restoration project. 7 years ago, the DNR again started purchasing walleye fingerlings with the accelerated walleye program. Pond management came to the front. The DNR was learning more and more about increased walleye fingerling production and restoring duck habitat. The private sector's knowledge has been used for years in DNR fish and wildlife projects. What do the Dakotas have that Minnesota doesn't? Dakotas have the ducks, the fatted minnows, and more landlocked basins than we do. Minnesota has what the Dakotas don't, is we now have carp, bullheads, and connected water basins. The only way to improve Minnesota is to go to individual pond management of our public waters, which private aquaculture has been doing and proven successful. This bill, Senate File 1517, if passed, will eliminate two sports-related activities in Minnesota, duck hunting and fishing. I have been working beside the DNR Fish and Wildlife Departments for over 20 years. It has been proven that the reason I have waterfowl in my ponds registered under my private hatchery license is because of intense pond management. Many or very few other waters in Minnesota are managed in this way. It starts with registering the pond through the DNR. This process checks to see what fish species are present. When only fatted sticklebacks, carp, or bullheads are found, the water is considered to have little or no public value. Once registered, I have become the manager of the pond with the DNR overseeing this process. The first step in managing is to have an intense rough fish removal program. Global warming and the creation of large ponds caused by tiling doesn't allow for normal winter kills of rough fish in these ponds. The next step is to use salt and barley to control algae. This improves walleye fingerling production and waterfowl habitat. In Senate File 1517, it states that the ecological value of a water must be restored to its original state. The best managed waters are licensed waters through the private aquaculture. The wetlands set aside as waterfowl production areas and waterfowl management areas are great when first built, but the management of the water is then forgotten. Would you either as a human or as a duck rather live on a pond with ducks, duckweed, scuds, clear water with walleyes, or a pond with dark, murky water infested with bullheads and carp, few to no scuds, and poor weed growth? That is the original state that most Minnesota waters are in right now. In 2006, I have personally raised 1,000 pounds of walleye fingerlings in a restored pond in my front yard with over 300 geese and 200 ducks nesting and feeding continuously. I believe I'd choose the condition of my managed pond that it is now in over the original state required by Senate File 1517. Senate File 1517 also states a person requesting a license must disclose a management plan and obtain written permission from each landowner. We live in a democracy. Everyone has an opinion. How can private aquaculture be held above, high above even our own government policy, saying that we have to have 100% of vote of landowners' rights over a public resource? That is why our public resources are governed by the state of Minnesota for the good of mankind, fish, and wildlife, not by one individual's opinion to shut down a public resource. How do you continue to improve on a pond management? This answer is clear. You know, you could increase the private walleye fingerling production, which will increase more management plans in the public waters. Kind of like killing two birds with one stone. By doubling the walleye fingerling purchases by the state of Minnesota, it would increase the ponds being managed, giving our state more vital duck habitat and better fishing opportunity. You, the senators, can make the difference by voting against Senate File 1517 and passing a new amendment, Senate File We Believe, in adding 40,000 pounds of walleye fingerling purchased by the state of Minnesota at the beginning of this biennium instead of waiting 2 years and watching water go unmanaged and lose out on better duck habitat and increase fishing opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bozek. Are your ponds all natural, or are some of them man-made?
I have very few man-made water. The one I restored in my front yard, it was blocking tiles and flooding it back out to, when I bought the land, the farm, it was just a low area. You know, you usually end up being pasture, cattails with no water in it. And I went in there and got a permit through the state of Minnesota, blocked the tile, flooded out the area, and created a new wetland there. Right in my front yard, that was able to do that. But it just, without natural water, we can't produce the walleye fingerlings needed to stock Minnesota waters.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was going to be one of my questions, Mr. Bozek, was If you were to, if there were to be no more, and I know that's not what the intent of the bill is, it's a moratorium, but if there were to be no more public waters available to fish growers in the state of Minnesota, would it become cost prohibitive to even grow them, bait and walleye? What kind of dollars are we talking about?
Well, it comes down in our area, land is selling for $3,000 an acre. And in order to flood that out, you're going to have the $3,000 per acre to originally buy the land and then turn around and spend the expense to have it, block tiles, dam up the... It's restoration projects is what it is. And the cost would be just incremental that it would put everybody out of business for now unless we get some kind of kickback. You know, some other program can be involved with helping it be restored. I mean, our waters we're using now are the bottom of the tiling systems. All the ponds above them have been turned over to ag or pasture land, and we're at the bottom of the water table where everything's drained into it, and that's why we have, you know, no winter kills anymore because we're dealing with 100-acre lakes that are full of carp and bullheads, and they have runouts where we have to require screening to try to keep them out. But, I mean, birds bring in these rough fish back into them regardless of what we do. And without, you know, the private sector has taken it one step further, and we make our living off of raising walleyes in these ponds, and we have to produce. So we have to manage them waters on a one-to-one basis. And that's the difference between the DNR's program of planting the same kind of ponds we're using, natural water, natural ponds. Their program is to dump the fry in there and go back in the fall and take whatever you get. And their production is averaging around 6 pounds per acre. The private sector's production is over 50 pounds per acre. I'm in excess of 100 pounds per acre on quite a few of my ponds producing walleyes. So our point of the private sector is, if more water would be turned over to us, we could actually drop the amount of water needed to produce the walleyes needed for Minnesota lakes.
Mr. Bozak, how many ponds do you farm?
I have under my license 54 ponds. For walleye rearing, I'm using roughly 10 of them that are, 100 to 250 acres in size.
Do you rotate ponds, or do they become unproductive after a period of time, and then you recharge them somehow, or how does that process work?
We normally get winter kills, and that gets you down to a smaller controllable population of rough fish in them and stuff, and that hasn't happened for the last 7 years, and that's a lot to do with why our ducks have disappeared. What I have to do myself under my business is go out there and actually literally move the carp and bullheads out of them waters and manage them that way. And like I say in my report, I got to go in there, apply like barley seed. Barley seed is used to control algae blooms. If you can control your algae blooms, you can get water clarity clearer in them ponds. By getting clearer water, you promote the aquatic life needed to sustain both not only our walleye industry, but also our waterfowl industry as well.
Other questions? Senator Ingebretson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll have to have the DNR ask this question, but how much, give us an idea, how many pounds the private industry brings to the state of Minnesota? Does the state of Minnesota purchase versus, and I understand you may also be selling to lake associations. Is that right? Is there any statistics on that?
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, right now our state contract last year was 45,000 pounds. Actually, it was just a little more than that. 47,000 pounds was purchased by the private sector, by the state of Minnesota. In addition to that, I don't have the rough number, maybe 30,000 more pounds of walleye fingerlings and carryovers that were purchased by lake associations and private individuals and stocked in Minnesota waters. And most of them waters that were stocking outside the state, a lot of them wouldn't be stocked at all if it wasn't for the private sector, because the state of Minnesota will not stock them if they don't have a public access on them. A lot of our water nowadays are 100-acre, 200-acre lakes. Prime example is up in the Duluth area where they've developed around these lakes, and now without private sector stocking, they wouldn't get stocked at all.
Do you get landowner permission now on some of these ponds?
Originally, I had 100% of my landowners. We got to maintain at least one to keep them. What's happened is a bad example in our area is the longer I keep them in clear state, the better they look driving around. And what's happened is we've got development ending up on them. You know, the better we produce, you know, better water clarity in our area especially. Now I've got developments coming in here. Farmers are selling out to developers, putting in developments on them lakes. And I'm left with multiple landowners versus, you know, a few landowners. And then we've gotten a different kind of opinion coming into them landowners. You know, they own 200 feet on this 300-acre pond. And now they want to shut it down for that use because they want to go not only take their half acre or whatever they own, they want to control the whole 250 acres of water they bought onto. You know, even though it's a public, our water in Minnesota is public. You know, so no matter if I create a pond, the water in that pond will still be public.
Other questions for Mr. Bosak? Do you, maybe I didn't catch it. Do you also raise bait?
I raise just a little bit. Like 90% of my business is walleye stockings in Minnesota. But I do raise just a few suckers. Fatheads are natural in every pond. You know, we don't have to have any ponds in Minnesota registered to trap fatheads. So like this bill talks about fatheads a lot, or it talks about minnows in general. But fatheads, I mean, if we got that pond, you know, like if we had one owner on this bill says that we can't be in there no more, and this is approved, we'd be kicked out, but you could still go back in there and put in 100 minnow traps and continue to trap minnows for the end of time. So the bill doesn't address that at all, that issue part of it.
Other questions? Thank you for taking the time to be here today.
Hey, thank you.
Senator Chaudhry, or others other that would like?
There's one other person on the list.
Okay.
Steve Fuchtel, Mackenzie Fish. I don't know if
Steve here? Okay.
Chaudhry, afternoon.
Yeah, Chair.
If you could please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Steve Pucktel. I'm with Mackenzie Fish. I'm in North Branch, Minnesota, and I've been farming fish in Minnesota and Wisconsin for a little over 30 years. I have a lot to learn, but I'm glad I could be here. I've been in this committee before. I've had some wonderful work done here. One of the things that I see, well, first of all, I grow trout for the boat sport and travel shows. We deliver them to those little fish ponds that they have, and also I have ponds that I grow trout in on my farm. I have around 100 acres of man-made water, and I see there's been some speculation on making man-made water. I sent Representative Scalzi an email stating that if you're going to drain a 10-acre pond 7 foot deep, that's 70 acre feet of water, which is 22 million gallons of water. Where do you put that 22 million gallons of water if we're going to drain it out to harvest the fish? One of the problems I see with of all ownership around a pond, first of all, most people that live on a pond or a lake, it's meandered water. They only own to the high water line. And if we're going to have to make it mandatory that all the property owners have to sign or let us have that water to use it for fish farming, then we're giving rights to just a few people for that public water. All water that I have has to be authorized by the DNR to raise fish. One other problem I've seen is the speculation on how bad minnows are in the ponds. In my lifetime, the Minnesota Metropolitan Mosquito Council used to go around and put fathead minnows in all the ponds to eat up the mosquitoes. And a lot of them got transferred in the metropolitan area. And I don't know if that's still done today, but fish farmers do not put minnows in ponds. We don't want them in there. They'll eat our baby walleyes. Is there any questions?
Questions for Mr. Pucktel.
Yeah. Thank Mr. Chairman, I guess I would,
Senator
I, would, I would ask what your opinion of the bill is, and if there's certain pieces in the bill that are especially onerous, would you identify them for us?
Do you have particular parts of the bill that you have trouble with?
Permission is obvious.
pretty much the whole bill hurts our industry. I'm kind of in agreement if the Duck money bought the water and they own the water around it, they should have the right to use that for growing their ducks in it, and it shouldn't probably be used for fish. I can't speak for everybody. That's just my own opinion. One other thought I have that I think we have the ability to work with this. I'm awfully scared for myself that when we start restricting any one group, like us fish farmers, that's real easy to jump over to. I have a 80-acre lake that an individual bought 200 feet on that lake, and two other farmers own the rest of it. And he reads in a local magazine or article that ducks and fish don't get along, so he gets the other two farmers to take away my permission to use that water. Well, he has 200 acres or 200 feet of frontage on this lake, and he doesn't want me to grow fish in it anymore, and I can't. I've lost access to it. But I noticed that he has all of his duck hunting buddies out there on the weekends. This lake is only half a mile from my house. And he has all of his duck hunting buddies out there for the weekend, and the two particular farmers don't like duck hunters. But they can't stop him from bringing his people on to duck hunt, but he can stop me from using that for growing fish because I need permission. Thank you for letting me speak, Chair.
Thank you for your honesty and your brevity. I appreciate it. Any other questions? Senator Ingebretson.
Senator, I would have the DNR a couple more questions, and then I'm done.
Okay.
Thanks.
Mr. Pyer or Mr. Bogus, do you have a preference, Senator? Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair, we'll see what the question is.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You drew the short straw, I guess. Can you give me an idea how many ponds are licensed to private dealers in the state of Minnesota and what state they are in right now?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, there's about a little over 2,000 ponds that are privately licensed, and they amount to about 42 or 43,000 acres. And I'm not aware that we have an assessment of the quality of the water in all those ponds. Mr. Pyer is saying no, we do not.
Mr. Bogus, just in reference to the bill, if you look at starting on line 1.11, I understand the DNR raises some of its own stocking fish. Do you have to then follow these same rules, file a management report and restore waters to original conditions, and is that also something the DNR is required to do?
Mr. Chair, our understanding of this bill, and I haven't had this discussion with Senator Chaudhry, but I've had it with Representative Scalzi and Representative Wagenius in previous years, is that the intent of this is at licensing for private use. As we've worked through this process, DNR has agreed that state use of wetlands should follow the same rules as private use of wetlands. So that's what we're striving for, is that we're not going to impose in our management something that's more restrictive than what the state does. But my understanding of this bill is that it would not affect the state use of, and there are about 400 wetlands that are used by the state. 350, Mr. Pyer says, around 350 wetlands that are used by the state for producing the fish that we stock for public waters. So, but my understanding is that this bill would not affect that directly.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, I get the drift from your earlier testimony that the DNR is not supporting the bill before us. And listening to other testimony, I see that on page 1, paragraph D is particularly troublesome for some because of the issue of getting written permission from every last landowner before you can start using the pond. And I'm just wondering, you know, if there's some way to kind of fix this up so that it's more acceptable. And I'm also wondering, in the case of your 350 ponds, if you have to follow all these requirements in here, how does that affect the DNR? If the DNR was, I guess an argument can be made is that if we're going to treat private fish producers one way, why shouldn't we treat the DNR the same way? Why would you be special? And so if you had to live under the regulations in this bill, how would that affect you?
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, our review of the language in this bill is that it would be, in most cases, it would be very difficult to make a determination that putting fish in these water bodies is going to restore them to their original condition. So it would in many cases, it would mean that we would no longer be able to use that pond. In terms of the paragraph D, written permission from each owner, I'm not certain what effect that would have on the state ponds. I guess we don't really know what effect that would have on the state ponds, but I know we've expressed concern on previous sessions on similar language that just on an overall philosophy basis, we have some concerns about extending control of use of public water, more control of use of public waters to riparian owners. And this bill would basically extend more control over use of public waters to riparian owners than exists now. And that's just, it's not specific to this issue, but it's just a general concern that we have that riparian owners not have control over use of public waters.
Thanks, Senator Chaudhry. Follow-up, Senator Dill, and then I've got a comment.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, can you identify any part of this bill that you could support?
You paused too long.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, we're happy to continue to work on this issue. I'm having trouble pointing to a specific section right
now. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, that probably helps my bill quite a bit.
And I think Senator Chaudhry in his opening remarks talked about this is not going to get hammered out today. I know that we've got two other hands in the air, so, and we have other senators here with bills to present. So, Senator Parasol, let's go to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, after hearing Mr. Bogus's comment, I'm sure that I can probably answer my own question by this, but I think I'll ask it of him anyway. Paragraph J, the last paragraph in the bill, which is the prohibition on using migratory waterfowl proceeds for any of the acquisition, apparently. And I wonder if that's a factor today, or is this something new that has it happened before?
Mr. Chair and Senator Parasol, that's a good question. It's something that that we are actively looking at as we speak. We've got a team of GIS interns digitizing the boundaries of our licensed ponds. We've got the data from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and in fact, the House version of this language extended this to federal easements, which is really the big amount of easements. We don't do easements with state duck stamp money, but we do have the federal easement data, and we are. It's in a different format than our data on licensed ponds, so we're having to do some conversion and digitizing, but we are looking at this has not been something that we've looked at in the past, is whether or not there's a federal easement. The federal easements protect the wetland and the upland from drainage or filling or things like that. They don't have specific restrictions on this activity. Certainly, you could argue that it would make sense to do what Jay is talking about. But we, right now, today, I can't tell you how much of this overlap there may be between licensed ponds and these easements.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm assuming then that this is only federal money that's stated in this, or is that some state
Mr.
stamp
Chair
money?
And Senator Parasol, the way the bill is right now, it's only state money.
It's only state, okay.
Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, what's the problem with the fish farming that is going on today that this bill is supposed to correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the concern is that when you have a natural wetland and you put fish in it, that it can cause that water quality of that wetland to deteriorate to the point where it won't support submergent plants or the invertebrates that use those plants and the oxygen that's in the water. And so waterfowl and other wildlife are feeding on the invertebrates and the seeds produced by those submerged plants. You see the dabbling ducks, the mallards, feed by tipping up, and all you can see is their butt sticking up out of the water, and they're eating the invertebrates, they're eating the seeds off of some of that submergent vegetation. When that goes to a turbid state, it loses all of its food value for waterfowl.
Yes, thank you. And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, are you finding that over the years of this happening that the fish farmers are having to move to new wetlands because they are, in fact, is there some inventory or evidence of that state of turbidity that's caused by this and that they're moving on to other wetlands and doing the same thing?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, we don't have that kind of data to show that. I know the total numbers of acres of wetlands that's licensed for private aquaculture has been fairly stable, at least over the last 5 or 6 years. There was an increase in the 90s, but it's been fairly stable since 2000. And we know there's increased turbidity of all sorts of wetlands in Minnesota from a variety of causes. So we don't have the data to say which ones specifically have been caused by licensing for aquaculture.
Mr. Chairman, are they staying in the same ponds or do they keep moving? The permit.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, we are not seeing a lot of when we proposed the moratorium language a year ago to buy us a little time on before we license new ponds for this activity. We wanted to have some time to try to work out a different approach, and at that time we were looking at maybe 15 to 25 new ponds being licensed per year. So they're out of 2,000 total. So if they're moving around, it's within the ponds that they already have licensed, because we're not seeing a lot of new ponds.
We'll finish with Senator Ingebretson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to belabor this any longer, but just with what you just said, Mr. Bogus, with regards to the permits not going up, and with what you also said with no water pond assessments done by the department to see whether this fishing industry is hurting the waters, would it be your opinion that maybe we should just step back and take a look at this a little bit longer? Is that what you're saying? You'd like to do a little more research on this before we move further? Or, I mean, is that a fair assessment of what I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, we've been doing a lot of research for a lot of years, and we realize we're never going to have all the answers. So we would like to look at some different ways of licensing this activity that tie the benefits of using the public wetlands more closely to the cost of licensing, which we think could provide some incentives over time to make sure that those wetlands that are being used are being maximized. And we know we can't, or we don't believe we can just shift this activity completely out of natural wetlands in the next year, but we think that we need to look at where is it having a detrimental impact, how can we try to move that industry in a different direction. And we do think that there are some policy things that could be pursued along those lines, but we'd like more time to talk about them with the aquaculture folks, with the waterfowl folks, with the wetland ecology folks, and see if we can come back with some language. And I do apologize that we did not have language ready for this session, because that was our intent to do that, and I know in the absence of that, there's a desire to see something happen on this issue, and we certainly understand that.
Senator Chaudhry, I've just been handed a note that Tom Landwehr is now here. It's your call as to what you want to, if you want to continue this discussion.
I'll just provide some closing remarks.
Thank you. Senator Dale.
Well, just, Mr. Chairman, there's a gentleman sitting behind Senator Chaudhry who's had his hand up. I think he wants to have a chance to say something.
I'm sorry, I did not see you. Please identify yourself.
My name's Rob Jost. I'm president of the co-president of the Minnesota Fish and Bait Farmers Association. I also own Minnesota Muskie Farm by Alexandria. And I just have a couple quick comments. I'd just like to thank Senator Chaudhry for meeting with us yesterday. We met in his office for about 50 minutes, and we had a good meeting. And just to kind of overview, the wetland issue is complex, and the aquaculture is not the only entity affecting wetlands. And as we do go forward to improve our wetland conditions here in Minnesota, I would just like to say on behalf of our industry, we would sure like to be included in that process of improving our wetlands. We're out there in the wetlands every day, and I think we could bring a lot of help to developing the overall wetland improvement plan here in Minnesota, and that's just all I have to say.
Questions for Mr. Jost? Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Senator Chaudhry, how do you want to wrap this up?
Let me just touch on a few issues. The first one I wanted to make sure you mentioned, this bill does not have a moratorium in it. The Senate did pass a moratorium last year, but this bill does not have that moratorium. The other issue I wanted to touch on is it's really important with aquaculture to distinguish kind of the different fish that we're talking about. And they all have kind of different effects. Some of them actually can be positive. And that kind of goes to the complexity of the wetland issue. I mean, we always hear about wetland complexes, and that's no lie. I mean, there's not only is there's diversity of plant life, but there's diversity of water conditions. There's diversity of animal life. So, for example, you've got walleye. Mr. Bozek talked about the walleye in his situation helping clear up some of the water that he uses, and that can certainly be true. That can happen. The DNR, what the DNR discovered is that the effect of walleye introductions into a basin depends a lot on the pre-existing fish population. So you've got bait minnows in the water already, and you introduce walleye, then those walleye are eating up the bait, and that's actually a net positive. The walleye fry can suppress minnow populations by that predation, and that the older walleye, the bigger ones, can help suppress minnow populations. However, when you have supplemental feeding of walleyes with fathead minnows, you can have adverse effects on a basin. You can also have a negative impact if there is aeration used, or if there's fertilizer used to increase the fish yield, so there's some differences there, and then you've got the fathead minnows, which are naturally occurring, a bait company goes in, takes all the fathead minnows out, or a lot of them. And that can improve the turbidity. So some of these bait folks actually do us a favor in terms of turbidity by getting some of the fathead minnows out of there. And then you've got the sucker minnows. These are the huge minnows that use to fish with northerns. Those have an effect on turbidity as well. I think the most important thing that I heard, for me, what I heard Mr. Bozek say was the need for individual pond management. I really agree with that. And that's what the main thrust of this bill is in paragraph C, where we're talking about the submission of a water management plan to based on the ecological value. The comment, however, that of restoration to its original condition is a fair one. I think that that's probably going to be difficult to achieve. In fact, its original condition, we may not want its original condition. If there are a lot of bait fathead minnows in there and we're taking them out, that's probably a good change. So that's a part that I'm interested in altering. The DNR following the same guidelines as private industry, I totally agree with. And then we probably have to clarify, there's probably a difference between man-made ponds and the naturally occurring ponds that we would have to address. Paragraph D on the shoreline owner permission issue. The statement that this is a public resource is correct. And that includes the people who live around the lake. They are part of that public resource as well. And so it's for everyone to use, and not just one individual or company to, without anyone's knowledge or say-so, to come in and change the ecology of a body of water. And I think that's what paragraph D is getting at. I probably sympathize with the statement that it's going to be hard to get every landowner, every last landowner, to get to sign on. But I think it should be more than one. If you could imagine, as a public resource, imagine yourself wanting to find a good a place to retire where you can hunt ducks or fish a certain species, and you choose this lake, you research the lake, as I did with my cabin, to find out, you know, is this good for ducks? Is this good for something else? Is this good for beavers? Who knows? And you spend a whole lot of money buying the land based on this resource and the condition that it's in. And after you've made this huge investment, without your knowledge, without any say-so, without any future plan for the ecology of your lake, someone comes in and changes it. That's wrong, too. So I think this issue needs to be addressed. We spoke with Mr. Jost and others yesterday about some other ways to address this. Maybe not every shoreline owner, but I certainly think that it should be one, more than one.
Some landowners that own the water, the land onto the shoreline.
I think those are the major issues with the bill. Again, on the restoring the original ecological value of the water, that is it's a good question. To what? And even to what may have been a bad thing. Maybe aquaculture helps in some instances. So I'll certainly look at altering that.
Senator Chaudhry, would you stand for a question? Senator Deal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, and Senator Chaudhry, on this paragraph D, trying to get the permission of all these adjacent landowners before you can raise minnows or use it for walleye production. As you were talking, I was thinking about the South Fork of the Crow River. And in this committee, we had a bill that, or I guess it was an Ellen Anderson's committee, Senator Anderson's committee, to designate the South Fork of the Crow River as a canoe route. And so there's going to be trees removed from the river so canoes can get up and down the river, and canoe access points and signs and campsites and so forth along that river. But we didn't go along and ask the landowners on the South Fork if that was okay. Matter of fact, we didn't get permission from any landowners along the South Fork. We are making that decision as elected officials of the state of Minnesota. I represent that area in the state Senate, and we're doing it as elected officials, and never mind what, you know, getting permission from all the landowners up and down the river. The same is true for the Loose Line Trail, which has been in place since 1972, but we're thinking about paving it now. And we're not going up and down the trail and asking every landowner for permission to pave the trail. It's a decision that's being made basically by those of us at the Capitol. And we're getting resolutions of support from local units of government and so forth that represent these areas. But we're not getting, nobody said go down there and get permission from every last landowner along the Loose Line Trail before you can pave it, because that's just not going to happen. And I also see that another example would be Swan Lake just north of Dassel, which is connected to the Crow River, and the water goes up and down in the lake, just got like it goes up and down in the river. It's almost part of the floodplain. And there's an attempt to control the water coming in and out of the lake at one access point, so when the water gets in the lake, it stays there and doesn't, when the river goes down, the lake doesn't go down. And we're not asking every single person on the lake for permission to do that. It's a decision that's being made by the county commissioners and the DNR, and the leaders of the Lake Association are supporting that. So at any rate, there's a lot. The point is that we do a lot of things around here based on decisions by representatives of the people without getting permission from every last person to do it. So I really think on paragraph D here, to me that's problematic, to run around trying to get permission from every last landowner. After all, the water is public water, and the DNR already is making lots of decisions on water in the state, and we're making them here today. So I'm just wondering, what I've got written on my bill here, that's your bill, but I between lines 1.15 and 1.21, I wrote delete.
Is that an amendment?
Is that a comment, Senator Dill, or an amendment?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, make some fair points, but also consider some other things. When we have the DNR and the Lake Moriah Lake Association, Lake Sarah Lake Association, and the and Ducks Unlimited and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service all come together to do a drawdown and a restoration of Lake Moriah in Senator Vickerman's district, they had to get the permission of every landowner before doing that. They had to do that. More prominent example is Lake Christina. The turbidity on that was incredible. They had to do an intentional drawdown and a freeze out of Lake Christina before, in order to improve it. They had to get the permission of every landowner. Now, on some, this is probably a different situation because there's probably a different ecological impact of. Well, there is a different ecological impact of aquaculture on a wetland. Some say it's, in some instances it can be bad. Some instances it can be an improvement. But nonetheless, the folks who live around that body of water should have some say. Maybe not every last one, Senator Dill, but I think it should be more than one. So maybe we don't want to delete this, but let's. It's my intent to lay the bill over, and we can work on some better language.
Senator Dill.
Well, just one other thought, and that is that if you have a person that wants to get into the production of livestock, dairy, whatever, and we pass a law here at the state that says you can't do it unless he gets permission from every last neighbor that he's got, say within a mile or adjacent landowners. I mean, that wouldn't sell very well. And when you're trying to build a new highway, and you need more land right-of-way, and you're going to redo the road, you just can't expect to get permission from everybody. Somebody's going to be holding out. You've got to use the power of eminent domain to get the job done.
And it's, Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, with respect,
Senator Chaudhry,
there, for all of those examples, there is still a process of approval, local process of approval. If you're setting up a new farm or if you're building another road, you're going through a local approval process in some way, shape, or form. So I'm not proposing that here. I'm not proposing that. I mean, that could be even worse for the aquaculture folks than what I'm proposing. But let's figure out some things, some ways that are reasonable, that address the concerns but don't hurt an industry.
Mr. Jost, Mr. Bozick, are you satisfied with that as of today? Or
Yes, I think there's going to be some legislation passed eventually on these issues, and we are definitely not in favor of this language, but we would like to be we'd like to work together over the next year and work something out that all parties can be happy with.
Thank you. Senator
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't say the next year.
I understand.
We've been working on this for a number of years, and we keep hearing, give us some more time, give us more time. The issues keep recurring. But nonetheless, we'll work together.
I'm going to lay this lay it on the table for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Just lay it on the table?
Why don't you just lay it over?
We'll lay it over.
How about that?
Thank you.
You convinced him.
So we can call. I see we have Senator Olson is here. Senator Dibble, would you yield to her? Or
no.
Do you need to go? I mean,
my only concern is I've got some witnesses who came out from Lake City. So,
Senator Olson, can you wait?
I'm supposed to start sharing data preferences at 3 o'clock.
Senator Dibble will get us out of here by a quarter to, and then we'll get you done by 3.
All right.
Senator Dibble.
All right.
Good work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble is here today with Senate file number 1671. Senator Dibble, it's all yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And while my witnesses set up their display, I'll just give a brief overview. And I'll start, Mr. Chair, by offering the A2 amendment.
Senator Dibble has an A2 amendment. And
and I'll explain that while it's coming around.
Sure.
So we can save time.
Thank you.
The A2 is identical to the language that was offered in the House. And so we're just trying to pull the bill into conformance. And the goal of that amendment was to make sure that there was a zero fiscal impact and to gain the support, or at least the lack of opposition from the state agencies as well as the local units of government, and this amendment accomplishes that goal. Mr. Chair, this bill proposes to encourage the use of better public lighting systems and fixtures to accomplish several different goals. First and foremost is to save energy and, of course, the corresponding costs, public costs that come with our lighting expense for streetlights and the like. Secondly, is to improve safety for motorists and pedestrians. Interestingly, when we use better light and frankly less light, the quality of our light improves for motorists and for public safety. And to eliminate nighttime light pollution for those who, of course, want to enjoy the nighttime sky for a variety of reasons. It also has the benefit of improving the environment for wildlife. And Audubon is here, and they're going to talk just for a few minutes about the difference it makes for migratory fowl. The proposal as amended sets standards only for those new lights or replacement lights that use state funds, and then it calls for the establishment of a model ordinance to be developed by state agencies in conjunction with various stakeholders and local units of government that local units can use voluntarily. We talked a lot about that subject recently, by local units for their use and benefit. With that, I'll renew my motion on the A2 amendment.
We have the author's amendment, the A2 amendment, to put the bill in shape here for Senator Dill. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Go ahead, Senator.
And, Mr. Chair, we have someone visiting from Lake City.
Lake City.
Who's been very active in this subject, in this effort over a number of years.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Tina Thevenin from Lake City, and I am the representative of the for the Minnesota state of the International Dark Sky Association. So when anybody calls the International Dark Sky Association in Tucson, Arizona, and they want someone to talk to in Minnesota, they give them my name. What I would like to do is give a short presentation to cover the concerns, and I'm going to ask a question. If I speak up, and I could speak without a microphone.
Could you take the microphone with you? Okay. Thank you.
Okay, the Minnesota Outdoor Lighting Bill will, one, increase safety, two, reduce greenhouse gases, and three, save money. There are many other issues involved with outdoor lighting, and Audubon Society is going to address the ones for the migrating birds or other outside wildlife. There are also human health issues, but I will only really identify the three or cover the three that are most important right here. Let me talk about the problems with outdoor lighting because they are very, very significant. This is the typical outdoor light. The light can shine up. It can light sideways, causing trespass, and also causes a tremendous amount of glare in the eye. And we have to remember that one of the things that has been very poorly studied until recently, and which is actually making the most of the current lighting very outdated, is that when we have glaring lights into our eyes, we cannot see as well. So if we can reduce the glare or eliminate the glare altogether, we can see better. Even if we don't have more light, we can see better. So glare is a huge issue. Light trespass into people's homes is a huge issue. There have been lawsuits against that. It also affects people's health when they have all nighttime light affecting them while they're sleeping. Here, this word here is dark, and this is an indication that if this light shines into this person's eye, she can look here where it is lit up, but she cannot look, she cannot see very well in this dark area, and that is a safety issue. It's a very serious safety issue. Also, with this type of lighting that shines all over the place, we affect the sky glow, which of course reduces our enjoyment of the night sky. It also is a 30-40% wasted energy, wasted money, and it's excessive lighting. And it's the wasted money and wasted energy that I will explain more. There are several words that you should become very familiar with, which is lighting, cutoff lighting, and fully shielded or full cutoff lighting. And I'm going to explain that with this little light. This is lighting. It shines all over the place. It's very glaring. This is cutoff lighting. It has a cap over the light, but there is still a certain amount of glare. This is fully shielded or full cutoff lighting. And within about 4 weeks ago, the Illuminating Engineering Society of North America, which is kind of like the AMA for the lighting lighting engineers, has determined that what we really need to be moving to is fully cutoff lighting when it has to do with the safety issues of the public, whether it's roadside lighting or municipal parking lots or whatever it is. And this is very important for you to remember that. All right, let's look at what happens when we indeed put a cap over the light. This is now, you will see the light is actually shining down on the ground. That's where most of the time we need the light. Now, the amazing thing is that if she were to move, this little figure were to move over here, because she doesn't have the glare shining in her eyes, she would be able to see what is happening right here in this dark area. From now on, or tonight, when you're outside and you see a bright light, look around to see how much you can actually see. Then put your hand between that bright light and your eye, and you will be amazed how much more you can see. So that with a reduced glare, we have increased safety. We have greater security, greater visibility, and reduced glare, reduced pollution, reduced light trespass, and reduced sky glow. Let me talk about the other issue that I mentioned at the beginning. The issue of safety again. Do down lights or do up lights, the bright lights, do they result in greater security? Well, in 1977 and in 1997, the United States Law Enforcement Assistant Administration Department of Justice at both times did a very thorough research, and they basically stated at the end of all their research that there is no statistically significant evidence that street light impacts the level of crime. It goes counter to what we've always believed, that the more light you have, the safer it is. But it is not. This does not create safety. This makes things safer. So in other words, we have to get away from the outdated lighting to the new lighting. Now what happens, let me explain also, when we were talking about we can save money. Let me explain this with this little flashlight. You know, this little itty-bitty light bulb in here by itself is not all that effective. But the reason why a flashlight is so effective is because we've put a reflective surface behind the light bulb. So now we can actually reduce the number of wattage in this little light bulb and have a very good lighting on where we are shining. And that is the secret behind saving money. We put a cap over the light, and so instead of having 100 watt, needing 100 watt, we put a cap with a reflective surface over the light, and we can now go down to 50 or 60 watt. And this is the whole idea behind cutting down on the expense of the full cutoff light fixtures or fully shielded light fixtures. What we also get, of course, is reduced wattage, and that reduces the greenhouse gases. And everybody is talking about greenhouse and reducing greenhouse gases now. It is such a serious thing. And so the beauty of putting a fully shielded or full cutoff lighting fixture over a much lower wattage bulb, we have greater safety, we have energy savings, which is money, taxpayers' money, and we cut down on the pollution. And of course, the climate change is one of the big things that we're talking about right now. Very, very important. Let's also look at waste money. Uplighting wastes more than $3 billion a year in the United States alone. Here's the United States alone. Here's the West Coast coming up from the Gulf. Here's Florida and going up. All of this lighting here is the greater New York area. Here's the greater Chicago area. Here's Minneapolis. And this is about 15, 20 years old. All that light is going up. It's going like this. It's shooting it up. Completely wasted, and yet we're paying for it by money and pollution, and then paying for cleaning up the pollution. Just so that you know, Minnesota is not the only or the first state that is looking at this. All of the red states in red and in yellow have either introduced state statutes. The Department of Transportation is already working with some very strong statutes or rules for themselves, or they're working on it in some fashion or another. Texas and Colorado, California, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, there are some very, very strong states. And the reason why I mention that is that Minnesota is not inventing the wheel. This has all been done before. There will always be a few yeah buts. We can't do it this way. And one of the yeah buts is, along the highway, we'll have to move the lighting poles closer. That is proven not to be the case. Another yeah, but is that it's very expensive. The city of Calgary just changed over all of their lighting, and they're expecting to save about lots of money, $1 million a year. I'm very free with my numbers, so you can't depend on that. But they're saving a lot of money. It's $1 million, okay. Just a smaller example, Premcor is a oil refinery in Texas. They changed over all of their lighting. The workers love it because they're now all full cutoff. They no longer have to deal with their glare.
And they're saving a lot of money. We'll stick with a lot of money. It saves a lot of money. Another yeah but is the billboards. And this is not an issue. We're not here to talk about pro or cons of billboards. We're talking about the lighting. And a lot of billboards still have the lighting go straight up. And yet in those states that say, hey, you know what? If you're going to have a billboard, how about lighting it in such a way that only the billboard is lit and it produces no glare? So that's a very, very valid issue. And then there are also some concerns of what about the negative impact on the industry? Well, there doesn't seem to be a problem. It doesn't seem to be an issue. This is actually happening all over the world. Companies, industries, Department of Transportation are all finding out that when they do this, there is a very, very rapid payback. And it is a win-win-win situation all over the place. So let me just wrap up. Minnesota Outdoor Lighting Bill will increase safety. And if you're still unsure about it, I hope you ask a question, because it does. It will increase safety, reduce greenhouse gases, and save money. And these two are very intimately connected. And the beauty is that we will all save. One of the ways we talk about safety is walking on the street. But there's also the Illuminating Engineering Society of North America, and they have a lighting handbook, the 9th edition that came out around the year 2000. And this is what they say about human health. They have found out that all of life on Earth evolved with periods of dark and light. And all, well, except perhaps deep in caves and on the bottom of the ocean, but we all need to be exposed to periods of dark and light. And if we are not, then this is a quote that I'll take from that. In addition to entraining melatonin secretion from the pineal gland, light can also have an acute suppression effect of melatonin. Specifically, exposure of the eyes to light at night can cause a rapid decrease in the high nocturnal synthesis and secretion of melatonin. What happens is that during periods of when we are exposed to dark, our immune system gets up. Now they're doing very serious research of people who are either working all night or have a light from a street light shining into their bedroom all night long. Are they more at risk of breast cancer? This is very serious. 100 years ago, we started using light as if we could just introduce it into the whole complex of nature. We're now finding out that we've been playing with something that may not be all that easy. So, do you have any questions for me, or otherwise Audubon can step up?
Questions for Ms. Thevenin. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Thevenin, have you got any solution for dealing with automobile headlights?
Headlights.
They can glare this red in your face, and yep. Even some of these new that seem to be, I don't know what they are, but they're actually more penetrating.
The halogen lights?
Oh, they're awful.
No, I can't go in there. I wish I could, but no, I can't.
That'll be our next bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think Audubon has indicated their willingness to forego their testimony. Suffice it to say, you might have read in the newspapers recently, they're working with building owners to voluntarily turn off their lights at night, particularly during migration times. It has an impact on birds' ability to migrate successfully.
Senator Dibble, you're setting up a model ordinance here. Is that right? I mean, you're not advocating changes tomorrow.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Well, I am advocating for changes going forward for lighting fixtures that that would be replaced, or new fixtures that are installed that make use of state funds, but only if that's a cost effective and doesn't violate safety standards as determined by state agencies or local units. For the purpose of local units of government, yes, we're just establishing a model ordinance so that local units could consider adopting those ordinances.
Senator, are these lighting fixtures available?
Mr. Chair, yes, they are.
Are they competitive?
Yes, I believe. Well, and they're certainly competitive in their operating costs.
Right.
Right. And
are they competitive to purchase?
I think they are in some cases. In some cases, they can be more expensive. Do you have more information about their upfront costs?
No, I don't. I don't have anything.
Senator Olson, did you have a follow-up?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other Questions?
I might add that General Electric has for years now produced more of the cutoff or full cutoff lights than just the ordinary old standard lights. So they know that the market is moving in that direction and they're being bought.
Mr. Chair, I would call your attention to lines 2.24 and 2.25. If the lighting system is going to cost more than 15% upfront capital costs, then the agency or local unit could forego their installation. Additionally, if they're going to cost more than 10%, but I'm comfortable with that language because I know that we will be saving money by using these lighting systems and fixtures.
Senator Diebold is, or go ahead, Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your presentation, you didn't talk about like fluorescent versus decent or whatever other kind of light. Does that make a difference, or is it just strictly the type of light?
Light fixture, Mr. Chair. Sir, I can't go into that. You would have to actually speak with a lighting engineer. But the concept is to start using fully shielded lights, which then means we can use less wattage in the bulb. And the details of that, you would have to go to an expert.
Other questions?
Senator Mr. Chairman, I just have a question to Senator Diebold, the way this is drafted. The hook for making this work is if state funds are used, then there's these criteria have to be met.
Right.
But in the definitions of outdoor lighting fixtures, we say the term includes billboard lighting. I'm not sure.
Where are you looking?
Line page 1, line 22. Term includes billboard lighting, and I don't know that we ever use state funds for
right.
billboards.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Frederickson, I think the reason billboard lighting is included is relates to the second part, the model ordinance piece, where the model lighting ordinance could pertain to lighting in the private sphere.
Other questions? Senator Sharon?
I'm sorry I had to step out for a moment. Did you talk about or have you – do you know if there are any communities in the state that are already applying model ordinances related to lighting?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, yeah, there's an article that I've distributed that talks about the city of Minneapolis and its efforts. Those came about because Minneapolis started installing its ornamental lighting all around the city, and you know, while the fixtures themselves are very attractive, they're architecturally significant. They're just dreadful in terms of the quality of light they produce, the amount of energy that gets used. You know, they're very glary. You know, they actually detract from the streetscape and the experience and the enjoyment of streets at night in Minneapolis. So Minneapolis is undertaking an effort. I think the city of Golden Valley is undertaking. I'm guessing the city of Mankato.
I know that we. We've been focused on this as well because of, you know, just the light pollution in and of itself, its impact on being able to do, at the university, they do a lot of study in astronomy. And it impacts.
Senator Olson, did you
Mr. Chairman, I just had a question relative to Minneapolis. Is it just the exterior lights of buildings, or isn't it shutting off the lights that are coming through all the windows of keeping a building lit at night? Isn't it both that would need to be addressed if you're going to affect right. the migratory birds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yeah, that's correct. This bill doesn't have that reach. However, this deals with the lights that are controlled in the public realm. Potentially, with the model ordinance, we could deal with the the private lighting. And Audubon is working on that first on a voluntary basis. But, you know, hopefully we'll enact some policy so the public building lights get turned off at night and maybe ultimately get to a point where we can be more sensitive to that issue.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson's point, might you need to have some clarifying language that if a fixture is going to be installed or replaced, that it's qualified to use state funds so that you don't draw that eligibility in that part just because you're wanting to allow it to be addressed in the model ordinance. You may want to think about that.
Senator Parasol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question to Senator Dibble has to do with, on the amendment, it's line 3.8, and special sub-districts. I'm trying to determine lighting standards that might apply in special sub-districts. Would that be athletic fields or something? I don't know what kind of special lighting standards might apply to a certain district.
I don't know.
I mean, you think of how athletic fields that are clustered together by schools or other facilities, and they have a glow of their own from a long distance, and so I don't know.
You might also think of
they have set different standards.
Racetracks, fairgrounds,
any large
ballpark.
Ballparks. Right. Thank you, Senator Vickerman.
Ballpark can't turn that dark.
Right. Yeah, and there are exceptions and consideration given for nighttime. Road construction, athletic activities, and the like. Tina has a response.
Yes, Mr. Chair. There are the manufacturers are coming out with very, very good lighting fixtures, specifically for areas that need for short times, such as athletic fields, downhill skiing area. That really concentrate the light on the field where it is needed and not out into the neighborhood where it is not needed.
Senator Dill, and then I think we need to move.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I'm assuming that some electrical engineer or some Lumen Nation engineer or somebody that's a real expert in all these definitions and percentages and numbers and so forth have looked this over and they've decreed that this is all workable and doable and understandable and all makes sense as far as
the luminaires
goes and so forth. Is that correct?
Yes, I am relying somewhat on the work of my counterpart in the House, but yes, that's how we came up with the 1800 lumens and all the specific kind of technical language in the top part of the section 3.
And who provided that special information?
To Phyllis Kahn.
Ms.
Mr. Chair, that information was probably gotten from the International Dark Sky Association that works very closely together with the Illuminating Engineering Society of North America. They work very, very close together.
And additionally, Mr. Chair, I've been in conversation and contact with my predecessor's brother, who's quoted in this article, Steve Orfield, who's a lighting engineer as well, who's also been working closely with the City of Minneapolis on their effort.
Other questions? If not, Senator Dibble would move that the Senate File 1671 as amended would be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on State and Local Government, I believe. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Thank you for your time. Senator Olson, I'm sorry I held you up there a little bit. Committee will be turning to Senate File 1094.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we have no controversy over this bill, we can go through it really quickly.
Well, I'm sure there won't be any then, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'm here this afternoon on behalf of Senate File 1094. And before we begin, there's an A1 amendment, which I believe you already have as a part of your materials.
It's coming around now.
And
it's coming around.
Oh, okay.
But you can certainly explain it to us.
Sure.
While we...
The purpose, first I should say the underlying bill initially was proposed to limit the availability of state forest land to 4x4, what are typically called mudder truck vehicles. And the amendment is being offered because it limits the application of the proposed legislation to four counties. So that's the significant change, I think, between the two. There are a couple of other minor changes. Well, actually, there's probably one significant change as well. The initial legislation, as proposed, would have limited its applicability to the development of trails, and I think there was inadvertently, the language didn't make it clear that this was to be a limitation on these trails in state forest lands, period. So that was clarified by inserting the to-be-used language as well. So that's the amendment. It's basically reducing its application to just these four counties, all of which are either all or part within my district. And so that's the amendment.
Someone would like to move that? Senator Anderson moves the A1 amendment. You're looking at it, committee discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Go ahead.
No.
It's an author's amendment.
No. It's an author's amendment, I believe.
This is the first time that this bill has been heard, so it is an author's amendment to put it in the shape I'd like to have it considered.
Are we okay with that? It's your bill then, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a witness here, but before I turn the microphone over, I would just like to make a few brief remarks about the reason this bill was brought forward. First, for those of you who are not familiar with these four specific counties, I feel very fortunate and privileged to have in my district four counties that are often considered kind of the lake, Central Lake Resort destination area for the state. These four counties encompass the Brainerd Lakes area up through Pequot Lakes, Pine River, the Woman Lake area, Walker, Leech Lake area, all the way up to and north of the Bemidji area. So this is often the Central Lakes destination, tourist destination for much of the state and even for surrounding states. Over the last number of years, it's also been the destination for a number of people, many of whom, in fact, a lot of us would argue nearly all of whom are from outside of this area, who come in with very large, what are called mutter trucks, which you've maybe seen some of these competitions on television or magazines. These are trucks that have been altered with very large tires and are promoted and advertised for the purpose of getting in and getting wet and getting dirty. And typically that's how they've been used, and they're used on state forest land. This is land that the public, that belongs to the public, and we've found that it is being used in a way that really is denigrating the land, causing a lot of erosion, a lot of problems, and really ruining the land for the rest of the public. The purpose of this bill is not to is not to limit use, motorized use of state forest land by four-wheelers, or to be, I guess, against motorized vehicles that can be used in a way that don't ruin the use of the land or ruin the nature of the land for other uses. But at a certain point, I think we as a public have a right to say enough is enough. I don't think we could come in there with a tank or a chainsaw or something else and say, because this is our hobby and this is what we want to do, these lands can be used in any way we want to. If it's going to despoil the land and cause it to not be able to be usable or cause so many problems that it just can't be done reasonably. And that's really the case with these vehicles. These are the extreme end of the type of motorized use. And frankly, the vast majority of the people in my area just don't want them there because of the problems that have been caused. And so rather than making this decision for the whole state, and to conform with what's been done in the other body, we're limiting this to just these four areas because this has been a very big problem up in this area. So at this point, I'd like to turn the microphone over to Jean Larimore, who's here to represent a group, an informal, loosely organized group in our area called the Jack Pine Coalition. This is a group with a membership, I've been told, up to as many as 2,000 residents up in our area, who are really specifically formed to be a to be able to advocate and speak on behalf of this issue and to stand as advocates and protectors of our state forest land. So, Mr. Larimore.
Mr. Larimore, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gene Larimore. I'm with the Jack Pine Coalition. Jack Pine Coalition began in part because of the trucker 4x4 truck trails in the Challenge Hill in the Foothills State Forest, which is more specifically the Spider Lake area. Throughout the whole state, and remember now we're talking only about special trails designed intended for 4x4 trucks. We're not going to eliminate, the bill would not eliminate, it's not intended to eliminate my four-wheel drive pickup, anybody else's, one of your Lexus, four-wheel drive Lexus. You could still be able to go on forest roads, on county roads, on township roads in state forest. There's only about 20 miles of these special trucker trails in Minnesota state forest. 10 of those are in the Foothills State Forest. And actually, there's an additional 8 intended in also in Senator Olson's district in the Paul Bunyan State Forest. Jack Pine Coalition and the residents of these areas want those trails gone. I've been to the Foothills State Forest half a dozen times. I've seen the trucker 4x4 trucker trail, and everyone who goes there has seen the Challenge Hill, which gets closed and gets repaired and gets opened. I don't know. You know, it may be closed at the moment. It's an extraordinary lesson in the damage these things can do. The Foothills State Forest is a very pretty place. It's a long, skinny forest, and it was kind of a glacial dump. So you have short but very steep sloped hills winding through them, and at the bottom of them you have streams and wetlands. Also, the soil is very sandy. I don't think the DNR cited this after an environmental review. I think the truckers said, we want to go here. And in that era, that's how it worked. This hill is, with the times I've seen it, I don't know this, I was not there last summer, so it may have been repaired and possibly better right now, but it's been enormously chewed up. It's a moonscape with ruts, no vegetation. Rocks have been hauled in. Logs have been hauled in so they can kind of, you know, crawl over them. Matter of fact, out west, these vehicles are called crawlers. At the bottom of this hill, there is a wetland with water standing, at least when I was there. And the erosion from the hill has spread out in an alluvial fashion, where if a farmer did that, if a logger did that, you know, they would be, they certainly would have been cited. Very purpose, this is my fundamental point, the very purpose of special four-wheel drive trails is incompatible with managing a sustainable forest. You just can't have both. Because the real purpose of a 4x4 truck trail is to provide challenges to the drivers of these vehicles. And given that purpose, it simply wrecks the forest. Well, here later, we have been testifying on this issue in the House, so they have heard my testimony. I have heard theirs. You will hear that. Well, these bad guys, these real bad guys with the wheels, the tires this tall, they go to Northeast Gilbert, and may soon be able to go to Appleton, Minnesota, where OHV Park is being developed. Those are different kinds of people. You will probably hear someone say that we just want a trail experience. We just want to drive our Toyota pickups like I have, you know, through the forest. My point is there are thousands of miles of those kinds of trails. In state forests and in the national forests, in Chippewa, which I am close to, there are all kinds of quiet trail experience kind of driving, if that is what you want to do, and that's fine. The government need do no more. That's already there. That infrastructure is there. If you start providing special trails, you will attract the outlaws, and I'm not saying the people who are going to testify here today are outlaws, on the contrary. But you will attract the outlaws. They will again start wrecking the trail, and they never stay on it. They always go off the trail. Designated trails attract problems. The Paul Bunyan State Forest, again, where these trails are proposed in Senator Olson's district, the DNR team, planning team, OHV planning team for that forest, did not recommend truck trails in that forest. And I've seen some of the notes that were written that said the soils are too sandy. I have driven with a friend through where that trail is now going to go, unless we enact this. And the hills here are much taller. It's one of our most beautiful state forests. It's almost like Appalachia. Big hills, with wetlands and streams at the bottom of them. And it is ripe for people to go off any trail into the mud. They're not called mudders for nothing, and up the hills. You know, it just should not happen. The DNR team did not want it to happen. The OHV Policy Committee, the DNR, St. Paul, did not want it to happen. Somehow, when it got to the sixth floor, Ian was sent back and said, we think you need some truck trails in this forest. This does not eliminate the possibility of these specialized truck trails in other counties, in other places in Minnesota. It has not gone unnoticed by the Jack Pine Coalition that these truck trails are in our area, and legislators continue to vote to have those trails in our area, but they don't have any in their own. Again, that's we perhaps get a little touchy about that. But the Jack Pine Coalition and the people of these four counties know what these trucks can do, and we don't want them anymore.
Questions for Mr. Larimore? Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I believe there are some other witnesses here who maybe have a different point of view who would like to be heard.
My list includes Lois Campbell, so if she's here, we'll take Lois next.
Mike Murdoch was planning on testifying and is on the agenda. I'd like to have him open this up.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name and members of the committee, my name is Michael Murdoch, and I'm with the Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association. I would like to begin with a picture for you all. This is a picture of a trespassing mud truck in the WMA and in more of the southern side of the state. This is a picture similar to those that have been shown in the back, speaking of mud trucks. And like Mr. Larimore had stated, you're going to hear testimony from me saying that we're not a mudder truck. I believe that the term mudder truck is very unfairly designated to us. Many of our members of our association and many of the people that we believe we're representing for these trails in the state, could be considered that. But what differentiates us from this guy who's trespassing in this water is the fact, simple fact that he's trespassing in this water. He's not licensed. He didn't get an OHV sticker. He's one of the statistics that you commonly hear of people that are trespassing, and that you very commonly hear are trespassing in this same area of these four same counties, particularly Crow Wing, that is the problem. All we're looking for is a non-challenge trail. to be able for everybody, including moms and dads and their families with their sport utility vehicles, to be able to drive through and view the scenery that they might not be able to walk to with their family. Horseback riding, ATV riding, motorcycling, I can't get a car seat to fit. I just can't do it. And we don't want a challenge area. I'm going to say it one more time. We do not want a challenge area. We've got the park for that location. And if a truck with mud tires goes onto these trails, they are bound by law to stay on the trails. We don't want anybody running off of the trails. We're looking to curb illegal activity. We're looking to have a place to go reasonably. And Mr. Larimore also spoke about a challenge hill in the state forest. And that challenge hill was, supposed challenge hill was shut down a few years ago and has never been reopened. And if there are any vehicles traveling on that challenge hill, they're legally operating, but I don't believe there are. It was reconstructed from our general fund or from our fund because of some what we believe to be non-truck damage. But that's of speculation. We just want a nice trail area. That's all we want. And if you shut us out, I really don't think that you're going to help curb these issues. We've got a DVD that we brought with us, and we believe it's really, really important that you see what we believe the majority of us represent and what we're looking for a trail. Mr. Larimore spoke of thousands of miles of trails for us to ride on in the state. There are no trails once we get shut out like this. There are minimum maintenance roads, which are roads. And roads aren't what we're looking for. And not only are they, when I say roads aren't what we're looking for, these are roads that are particularly straight, particularly been there for years, and are somewhat maintained. They're minimal maintenance, but they're somewhat maintained. They're going to be a wide thoroughfare that's not going to access or wind through any of the beautiful areas or give you access to the 5.6 million acres of land in the state. Please review our DVD, and please, hopefully, you can see that we're something a little bit different than what we're being made out to be.
Were you hoping? Are we seeing it now?
Yes.
Okay. Is Ms. Campbell, are you planning to speak as well?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Turn it on.
I'm giving equal time to each side. I've got two people, Mr. Larimore, Mr. Peterson, who have signed up to testify. Now, Ms. Campbell, you want to use your time for us to watch this video, I have no problem with that.
How long is it?
But how long is the video?
It's about 7 minutes long.
Yeah. But we're not going to watch the DVD and have additional witnesses. We don't have time for all of it today.
Could we cut the DVD a little bit short, possibly?
Certainly.
And have a few comments from Ms.
Certainly.
Again, thank you.
Yeah.
I'd like to pass around just this binder. This is my family's experience and what we do. I've been trail riding with my husband for 2 decades, and we are currently in a waterfall searching.
There's much misunderstanding about ORVs, perhaps because an ORV can be and do many different things. Generally, ORVs are four-wheel drive vehicles such as Jeeps, pickups, and SUVs. Some ORVs are home-built or are so modified that they can no longer go on the road. But most ORVs are street-licensed vehicles. May seem parking out of the home. An ORV must be registered with the state and display the ORV sticker on its license plate. This registration gives ORVs access to designated ORV trails, grant aid ORV trails, and off-highway recreation areas, such as the park in Gilbert. The money from these registrations, coupled with unrefunded gas tax money from gas used by all off-roaders, funds enforcement, education, and the creation and maintenance of off-road opportunities for ORVs. Unfortunately, many ORVs are unaware of this registration, so many users go uncounted. However, the Border-to-Border Trail Study cited 1992 research, which found over 600,000 Minnesotans reported being on the road in an ORV at least once a year. A nationwide survey of ORV users found that 11% of ORVs participate in light activities, 14% of ORVs are rock crawlers, and the vast majority of ORVs, 75%, are trail riders. Many trail riders reported taking their ORVs off-road for such activities as plant and or wildlife viewing, hunting, fishing, camping, rock climbing, photography, berry, and or mushroom farming, and even some activities related to their livelihood. A trail riding ORV is the most subtle in appearance, often modified, or only slightly modified, to handle tougher terrain. The average speed of an ORV on a trail is just 3 to 5 miles per hour. This slow speed, in addition to four-wheel drive, differential lockers, and high traction tires, minimizes wheel spin and hence impact. Trail riders can travel over a wide variety of surface conditions that a regular car could not. This is the thrill of trail riding, getting to go places and see things that one would not be able to without an ORV. Rock crawling ORVs are highly modified vehicles or scratch-built vehicles designed to go over the largest of boulders. Mud activities occur as organized events on private property in man-made condition. Lately, there has been a trend to refer to all ORVs as mudder trails. This is clearly an unfair misnomer, as mud activities represent the smallest segment of the sport. Only Alaska is blessed with more state-owned public lands than Minnesota. Minnesota's wide variety of terrain can provide opportunities for all different skill levels of ORV users. Through recreation areas such as the OHV Park at Gilbert, Minnesota has provided extreme rock crawling experiences in man-made mud pits. And through Minnesota State Forests, Minnesota has the ability to provide managed trail riding experiences for the low and medium skill level of ORV users, which is by far the largest sector of the sport. But providing ORV opportunities does not benefit ORV users alone. ORV users bring money into communities by way of spending at hotels.
Can we shut this down so we can move a couple more words?
Gas stations and more.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Chair and senators, my name is Lois Campbell, and my family enjoys riding in our Jeep. We do not consider ourselves mudders. In fact, I am, to this point in time, very offended when people talk about going mudding. It is not legal to go on state land and go mudding in the forest. You cannot go off the trail. You cannot go on a wetland.
Hold the mic up. Thank you.
It's taken everything and narrowed it down to putting everybody into this little ball that does it. It's not the correct basket to be putting in. We are being punished for the renegade actions of another group that participates in an unlawful activity when they are on public land. We ask that you see us as a different group, and we ask that you look at the facts. A big fact is that less than 2% of the violations that are attributed to OHVs, less than 2% of them are attributed to ORVs or to 4x4s. Less than 2%. So what this bill does is it's punishing us and taking away opportunities for people that like to go out and use the trails. It does affect the people with a Lexus ORV. It does affect the people with a Jeep. It affects all those people that do not use the mudder trucks, but they use them to go exploring. I have two children that have grown up. One has been in the car seat since she's been 4 weeks old. The other one since he was 4 months old. Nationally, ORVs are recognized as legitimate users of public land. There are several states with less public land that have extensive trail systems that do support it. Mr. Larimore brought this, his testimony to center on this Challenge Hill that is in the Foothill State Forest that was there. The history of that is that the DNR set showed us this hill that was totally and completely degraded before we started using it. Trucks had not been using it at the time. There were, my son could stand in there in the ravines that were 5 foot deep when we started that. We started this project, and it was in a point in time when the lawsuits were going on through MRR to a standstill. We were never able to finish this project. Instead, we started the project. We had spring closures that were open or that were put on way too late that spring. ATVs had gotten in there and they were dug in there. It was totally messed up. The commissioner's office says, that's it, we're closing it down. They went to a new policy that was no challenge areas. The DNR now says that there will be nothing developed other than touring trails. So we're asking that you take and oppose this amendment, this bill, that would punish people that are going out with their families and want to go riding. We're asking that you take and look past the stereotype that you have been what you see on TV. Let's walk past that and think about everybody else that uses those trails. DNR has testified on the House side that they wish to retain the ability to designate trails for ORVs on commissioner-administered lands. Would like to hear from the DNR that they may tell you that they would like to continue to have this opportunity to designate trails. There are so few that are designated. The DNR has the experience and the training. They have limited the number of ORV trails to a very small number. Right now, I think there's about 23 miles. 23 miles, it's about 25, would encompass about 25 acres of public land. 25 acres out of the over 5 million acres of public land, that's 25 acres so far. And I don't foresee that there's going to be many more, probably another, maybe twice that. So maybe 50 miles in the whole state of Minnesota, which would be so inconsequential. I would like to ask that you wait till December 31st, 2008, to allow the DNR to do their job at that point in time, then evaluate the process. And if there's trails there that are not working, we ask that's the time that you go in. I beseech you, please wait until 2008.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? Okay, Mark Peterson, Audubon Society. Senator Sashtog.
Mr. Chair, I'm just taking for granted that we're going to hear from the department, the DNR.
Certainly, we can call them up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Mark Peterson. I'm the Executive Director of the State Office of the National Audubon Society. In Minnesota, Audubon has about 13,000 members and 14 chapters around the state. Audubon Minnesota supports Senate File 1094. Pickup trucks belong on roads or hard tack scrabble areas, not in state forests, on 10-foot-wide, quote, trails. A more appropriate venue for these vehicles are challenge area parks designed specifically for trucks and other OHVs, usually located in only mining or quarry pits. Members might consider modeling another challenge area park after the Gilbert Off-Road Vehicle Recreation Area, a site specifically designed for ATVs and trucks that want complex off-road opportunities. As has been noted, only 24 miles of these trails exist, most of them in the Foothills State Forest, which is an upland deciduous and coniferous forest that is home to many bird species of concern, including flycatchers, warblers, and northern goshawks. The 11 miles in this forest contain 11 miles of this have mutter truck trails have proven disastrous in this forest. Trucks have ruined hillsides, caused deep erosion and forest fragmentation, destroyed habitat, and ultimately have driven out birds and other wildlife. Many locals will tell you that the character of the forest has completely changed. I'd like to remind the committee that in 2006, both the House and Senate passed language that prohibits new mutter truck trails in state forests. The authors cited the need for a more appropriate venue, public challenge area parks designed specifically for trucks and other OHVs. Unfortunately, in the end, the conference committee ignored the will of both houses and cut the language from the bill, despite that the language passed on both House floors. Now you have a chance to rectify the situation. And I would add that as we look ahead at the state of Minnesota, adding demographers project 1.2 million more people in the next 25 years without any additional increase in state forests, and a certain percentage of those wanting to have this kind of recreational opportunity, that the pressures on our state forests are only going to grow worse. It's not going to be alleviated. So I encourage you to support this bill, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Questions for the witness? All righty. Dean? I'm sorry.
Are you on the
okay. I want to hear from the DNR first.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Ron Potter. I'm with Minnesota DNR Trails and Waterways, and I do have some handouts that we need to run around. There's been a lot of discussion this afternoon about the Foothill system. We have managed a system, trail system in that forest for probably the last 6 years. And I would have to say that it's went very well. The map that's coming around does show that trail system as it exists. We have, there was a what they call a challenge hill, and the comments have been correct that it was never really open. The work that was done by the 4x4 group did stabilize that hill for us, stopped the erosion, but we have not allowed any use on that hill as it occurred in the past. Since then, we've routed a trail up over the top of it. And we did go in there 2 years ago and harden that trail. But it wasn't because of the truck traffic. That trail, as you'll see on there, is shared by all three uses. And it was the faster-moving traffic that was giving us some problems on the corners. So we went in and hardened it. Since that trail's went in, we have published a recreational trail guideline that has better defined how to build and maintain these trails in a sustainable manner. The ones that are at Spider Lake, we retrofitted those onto a ski trail, which if we were going to do it today, we wouldn't do it that way. But that is what we had to work with. We've made it work, like I said, for the last 6 years. We haven't had any significant maintenance problems. Where we have built these trails according to our guidelines, the only place so far would be at Gilbert, where we started with basically a clean slate. And our maintenance costs on the truck trails are definitely the least costly to maintain. But again, that's where we put them in the way that they were supposed to be put in. The other handout that I have would basically give you It's an entire map of the Foothills State Forest. So it shows you what was inventoried, what's proposed for the trucks, and what is basically where they're not going to be located. And when this map comes around, you'll see that the Spider Lake system basically lies in the southern part of that forest. Through the forest reclassification process, the team did identify another 3.5 miles. And you'll see that in brown, directly above that existing system. That new system is located on a power line. And from our perspective, that's a good place to put a use like this. We're not displacing any trees. It's not an area that is designed to grow a crop for us. It's an area that's designed to basically stakes we're supposed to keep clear of merchantable timber. And that's what the team proposed for the new route in the foothills.
Do off-road vehicle trails, 4x4s are ORVs, off-road vehicles?
Correct.
Do off-road vehicle trails have speed limits?
Mr. Chairman, no. Speed limit is basically dealt with through the design of the trail.
Okay. When you say you harden it, what do you harden it with?
Mr. Chairman, the situation at Spider, we used interlocking concrete block and actually laid block in the trail to harden that surface so the soil wouldn't move. We had a situation where, like I said, we had to go with an existing trail, and it was a ski trail, so it ran right down the fall line or went with the contour of the hill, straight up the hill. If we could have relocated the trail, we certainly wouldn't have done that. But we were told to stay there. So to deal with the water issue, we had to harden that surface so we could deal with the water without erosion.
So it kind of becomes a minimum maintenance road.
In that particular section, it was probably 150 feet that we had to do this on, and it's the only stretch in that, and that's 11 miles of trail that we've had to do that on. The map that's coming around now is the Paul Bunyan. That is the other forest where there's been a proposal for some truck trails. And again, the truck trails are identified in the light brown. And Paul Bunyan, as you can see from there, has a lot of roads and trails inventoried. The truck proposal is right down in kind of that southeast corner of the map, which is highly motorized already. That's where the Martineau motorcycle trail system is, and also the Round River ATV trail.
How many grant and aid trails are there? These trails that are designed to go through the forest and they wind around, and for these types of 4x4s, how many miles are they?
Mr. Chairman, this trail in the Paul Bunyan was proposed as a grant and aid. What we've said at this point is the department would build it, and then we would look at the club taking over the maintenance. The other proposal that has been submitted to the department is for a 6-mile trail up on northeastern Minnesota. But those are the only two grants that we have in process right now.
How long is the first one?
This one was originally proposed at 15. I think it ended up being about 7.
Currently there is a 7-mile ORV trail in the Foothill State Forest, correct?
That one's 11 miles in the foothills. Okay.
And then there's an 11-mile trail. Where's the 7-mile trail?
In the foothills, when it's... There was 11 miles. There's 4 additional miles proposed. And in the Paul Bunyan, there's 7 miles of new trail proposed. And then we have 1 additional mile proposed in the Solana State Forest.
But there may be more... But there may be more based on the inventory process.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Are ORVs allowed on minimum maintenance and forest roads currently?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are.
About how many miles of those are there? Is that just basically all the forest road trails or forest roads in the state they can go on?
Correct.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Potter, these four-wheel drives, this particular class of vehicles, do they buy a separate permit to put into an account? Or
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxon, yes, they do. They have to buy a special sticker. It's $30 for 3 years, and it goes into a dedicated account for providing trails for their use.
That's in addition to their registration?
That is their registration,
that
Mr.
is
Chairman.
Their, okay. I suppose because they are a car. Are these street legal? Do they drive along the freeway to these areas?
Mr. Chairman, they can be, okay. But this registration would be over and above the highway license, right. and it's separate from an ATV registration or a motorcycle okay. registration.
All right, Senator Olson.
I have a follow-up.
I'm sorry, we had a follow-up.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Mr. Potter, so how much money are we talking about here that's in the account or spent each year for maintenance, or do we have some idea?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxon, in the truck account, annually, there's about $900,000 that's coming into that account, and we're spending pretty close to that amount now on planning for the forest and enforcement and grant and aid.
I'm sorry, Senator Olson had a comment.
Mr. Chair, I think my comment or my question I was going to ask was addressed. It was similar to the question you were asking, but I'm sure you have limited time as well as I'm supposed to be chairing something next door, but before we end, I really would like to be able to follow up with my own response to some of the comments that were made.
Okay. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Potter, I have one other question, a follow-up to what Senator Saxon asked. You said there was $900,000 in the account, I believe. How much of that came from the gas tax, and how much is from the registration?
Mr. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, of the amount in the account, there's about $107,000 that comes from the registration, and there's about $840,000 that's coming from the gas tax.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Potter. That $107,000, over how many years was that, has that accumulated in the account?
That was annual registration in fiscal year 2006.
Thank you.
Senator Saxon.
One other question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Potter, the DNR is doing an inventory of state forest in terms of trails, somebody mentioned it should be completed by December of 2008.
Correct.
Mr. Potter.
So the question is, a bill like this, is it going to affect your inventory, or do you think it might be better if we just waited until after the inventory, which isn't all that wait, really, use the inventory of the trails to base on what kind of trails we need for different types of vehicles and skiing and whatever.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saxon, I think it would be a lot easier for the department if we could wait till 2008 to complete our assessment. At the rate we're going, we're not identifying a lot of truck trails. Of the first 17 done, we've only identified an additional 14 miles. It would be better for us if we could stay with the process we're using, but that's not necessarily our call.
Do you include periodic challenge trails throughout
this? Mr. Chairman, we do not provide challenge trails. What we have told our folks is that we use what's there. And that has been a little bit of an issue at Spider Lake, where the trail is shared with all the different uses. The trucks would like it that if a tree falls down, we leave it there. We don't necessarily remove them. And if you have ATVs and motorcycles also using that same trail, those trees do need to be removed. But no, we do not provide challenge in the forest. That's what we do at Gilbert and those type of facilities.
Okay. Mr. Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Potter, are there, or Senator Olson, the designated off-road vehicle use areas? I assume that those are different. They're obviously different than the trails. Could you explain if there are any of those in either of these two state forests?
Senator Sieben, I think, yeah, that would be something like the Gilbert area, I think, that's being referenced, and I'll defer to the witness.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Potter.
Senator, yes, that would be like our Gilbert off-highway vehicle area or the Appleton area that was referenced earlier. Those are specific sites in a defined boundary, not in a forest, where we provide different types of opportunity that we will not provide in the forest. It's for the more technical type riding or the more challenging. We won't provide those in a forest, but we would do those in a use area.
Senator Olson, why don't you provide some closing remarks for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to say that while I enjoyed watching this video, from firsthand experience living in this area, in my opinion, this does not in any way, shape, or form represent the type of use that's occurring or even the type of vehicle you're likely to see using these trails. First, remember, we're not talking about the average, or we're not talking about OHVs or what we call four-wheelers, the smaller things. We have trails for those, and this is nothing like that. Most of these off-highway vehicles have been modified with huge tires. If they were, the reference was made to how many of these there are and how many are being used as mudders, but it sounded to me like the description being used was including every pickup truck and every SUV in the state. Pickup trucks and SUVs that aren't modified, and even those that are modified, have hundreds of miles of low-maintenance forestry roads that they can drive on to get back into the woods, as far back into the woods as you want to go. And those are already there. And unless a vehicle has been really modified, they're going to be they're going to do just fine on those roads and have access. And you can certainly put your children and your child's car seat or whatever you want to do and get back into the woods for that kind of an experience. And there are hundreds of miles that are already there to allow people to have those kinds of experiences. What this group does, it's a very small, select group of people that is an extreme group that comes in. They make a lot of noise. They cause a lot of damage. They're usually, as I said, people coming in from outside of the area. And they're in very large trucks, and the idea that they're driving 3 to 5 miles an hour to me is just incredible. That's not how they're promoted, and that's not how they're used. The reason they have the reputation they have is for a reason. And I just wish I could invite all of you to come up there sometime and see what we're really talking about in terms of the type of vehicle and the type of use that's occurring. I guess the thing that we're asking you as legislators from the area to, and as the witness who represents a number of actually a couple thousand of the people who live in this area, is to recognize that there is a limit to what we can allow to happen in state land, especially in, you know, if you're from the metro area, these counties may seem sparsely populated to you, but from a tourist standpoint, from the number of trails that we already have, from the type of use from outside the state that this area sustains, it's pretty heavily used and pretty heavily populated. There are some areas of the state that aren't included in this bill that are maybe more not going to be used as much and are maybe more appropriate. But in this particular area, I guess we're just asking you to draw a line somewhere in terms of how we're going to treat our state forest and what kind of land we want to leave for future generations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, sir. We're out of time. I encourage you to submit your thoughts in writing. Committee, we're going to take a 10-minute recess for you to stretch, go to the bathroom, and get a cup of coffee. So we will reconvene at 4:02. Committee's in recess. Oh, I'm sorry. We are not. We're going to have to deal with Senator Olson's bill.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair.
Senate File 1094 is a laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Senator Dibble had a motion before we leave.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move to reconsider the motion that on my bill, which number I've forgotten. Do we know it?
1671.
Thank you. So I first make the motion to reconsider that motion.
Okay.
Which was to refer it to the State and Local Government Committee. Okay. The reason, members, Mr. Chair, is that we've spoken with Senator Rest, and she does not desire to see the bill. So okay. We want to just go ahead and reconsider it and lay it on the table here.
All right. Discussion. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And 1671 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee is in recess until 4:03.
You're going to just keep going.